Historian and civil rights advocate John Hope Franklin died Wednesday in Durham, North Carolina. He was 94. Franklin was a prolific scholar, perhaps best known for his book From Slavery to Freedom, regarded as one of the definitive accounts of the African-American experience. He was also intensely involved in the political and social issues confronting Black America, working over the years with W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King, and Thurgood Marshall. Born and raised in an all-Black community in Oklahoma, Franklin experienced humiliating incidents of discrimination growing up. He attended the historically Black Fisk University in Nashville and went on to teach at Harvard, the University of Chicago, and Duke, breaking several color barriers over the course of his academic career. Later in life, he chaired President Clinton's Initiative on Race and was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. Terry spoke to John Hope Franklin in 1990.
You were often in the position of researching segregation or researching slavery in libraries and archives that were segregated.
Yes.
Give us an example of some of the obstacles you faced there.
Well, when I arrived in North Carolina in the spring of 1939 to do research on free Negroes in North Carolina in the State Department of Archives and History, I went in to see the director of the archives one Monday morning, and told him that I was there to do research. He said, well, very frankly, when we built this building, we had no idea that anyone of your color would ever be coming here to do research, and therefore we don't have any facilities for you. Then he paused, and I looked at him. He said, but I suppose that you have a right to be here, and the only thing I ask you to do is to give me some time, during which time I can make some arrangements. He said, give me a week. Well, I was down there paying room rent and paying for my meals, and I thought that was a long time just to loaf around at my expense. And I just looked straight at him, and he knew, I suppose, what I was thinking, and he said, well, how about 3 days? And I said, well, I'll be back. And I went back at the end of the morning of the fourth day, and they had all things arranged. They had removed all of the materials out of a small display room that was used by the historical division of the archives. And they had put in there a table and a chair. And the search room was across the hall where all of the whites were doing their research and where the card catalog and all that were. And I was presented with a key to the manuscript stacks. And that was the understanding, of course, that the white attendants would not bring things to me, and therefore I would have to get them myself. Well, I would cross the hall, go into the search room, and go stick my key in the locked manuscript stacks and go in and come out with a wagon load of marvelous materials. And the whites would stop and look at me. And after 2 weeks of this, the director of the archives called me in and said, I'm sorry, but I'll have to take your key. I said, what's wrong? What have I done? He said, it is not that you have done anything. It is that all of the other people who are doing research here are demanding keys also, so that they can go into the stacks and have the privilege that you are enjoying. I said, they are being discriminated against, I suppose they would say. He said, that's what they said to me. And so he lifted my key, and then he said, well, I will have to require the attendants now to deliver the materials to you. And so from that day on, I would merely go over to the person who had charge of the reading room, the manuscript reading room, turn in my requests for manuscripts, then retreat to my little room and wait there until the manuscripts were brought to me by attendants who I suppose would have brought them anyway at the outset.
You said that your parents wouldn't stand for segregation when you were growing up. I mean, what did that mean exactly? Were there public places that they wouldn't go to because they didn't want to have to go to the segregated area?
Oh, yes. Neither my mother nor my father ever voluntarily segregated themselves. My father was a lawyer, as you know, and he would not tolerate segregation in the courthouse in Tulsa. When he took me to court with him, which was very often, after all, don't forget that I'm trying to apprentice as a lawyer at that point, and he would never permit me to sit where blacks were supposed to sit or expected to sit. I either sat, if it was a non-jury case, I sat in one of the seats where the jury would ordinarily be seated, or if it was a jury case, I sat at the bar, at the desk table with my father, and he simply wouldn't stand for it. Now, we lived in a city that was absolutely and completely segregated. There was not just, it was separate, and it wasn't just segregation. For example, there were no movie houses in which there were white sections and black sections. There were white movie houses and black movie houses. And the same thing was true of virtually everything else. The only place that I know where there was segregation of an audience was at the convention hall. There was only one such auditorium in the city. And it was to this hall that, say, the Paul Whiteman came with the orchestra and accompanied by George Gershwin, and I think it was 26 or 27. And it was to this hall that the Chicago Civic Opera Company performed every spring. My mother and father would not even consider going to such places. But I was a music buff, and so I wanted to go. They said, well, you go on your own. We wouldn't go. But there were other blacks in the city that would go, and I would go with them.
Do you feel bad about going? That you were violating a family principle?
The family principle really was that one could do as one pleased at this. There was, in other words, there was permissiveness because my parents did not think that this was an absolute cardinal sin, as it were. But it was a principle for them, which they did not insist that the children pursue. But I do, even now, at times reproach myself, despite the fact that I'm still an opera buff and was on the board of the Chicago Symphony for a number of years. The reason that I like this is because I experienced the humiliation of segregation in order to develop these tastes, and I don't think that's very pretty.
You know, some of your essays in your new book, you talk about some of the obstacles that you've faced as a black scholar, and you write that there's really, it goes beyond any discrimination you faced in the field itself. For instance, when you were the chairman of the history department at Brooklyn College, one of the problems you had was finding a house you wanted to live in because you weren't, a lot of neighborhoods just refused to sell to you.
That's right. I spent more than a year trying to find a place to purchase. This after my appointment there was of such spectacular nature that my picture and a long article about the appointment was on the front page of the New York Times. But when I set out to find a house near the college, I hoped that I would be able to walk to work. Almost no real estate dealers in the area would show me any of the houses that they were widely advertising. And when I finally found one offered by the owner, then I had the problem of trying to find the money to borrow to purchase a house. And that was another round of excruciating experiences. I finally found it, but I could have spent all this time much better.
Let me ask you a kind of stupid question. Did you ever take that front page article with you to the realtors and say, look, do you know who I am?
No. No, I don't believe in that. I think that I'm a human being. And that ought to be enough to commit. And I'm well-mannered, and I'm fairly well-dressed, and my conduct is, I hope, above reproach. And I think that ought to commend me. If that doesn't, well, I'm sure that they don't want to hear anything about who I am. I have no doubt that many of these people knew who I was, and yet I was still rejected.
Do you often ask yourself what your contribution to the present can be as a historian, as a scholar?
Of course. It's not enough to write race and history or any of the other 11 or 12 books that I've written. It's not enough even to teach in the great universities, as it's been my privilege to do. What one needs to do, and I say this to my students and to my friends, one needs to be an activist. One needs to do something about illiteracy. One needs to do something about these other tragic modes of conduct that we see. I'm always insisting now that if the university and if the college have been ivory towers, they cannot afford to be in our society as it is now. After having taught for 53 years, perhaps it might be difficult for me to turn to some of these more activist activities, although I hasten to add that I have done some of all of that throughout my life. I would myself like to renew my own activities and increase them. And I call on all young people of all races and of all ethnic groups to join in, for this world is no better than the least of the people in it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Historian John Hope Franklin speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. Franklin died Wednesday. He was 94.